Welcome back. My name's Adrian.
My name's Aaron.
And this is To Teach One, the podcast where we try to take complicated health and wellness topics and make them a little bit more simple and digestible.
Yum.
Indeed.
To Teach One.
That's our new trademark.
So are we going to record that into the intro that we, the professional one that
oh,
we do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It'll be me singing the Love Boat theme song with To Teach One, just, you know, interspersed throughout.
I feel like I remember that theme song and...
Yeah, and maybe not Love Boat theme song.
Maybe not Love Boat, as you know...
Captain Stewie.
Yeah, he knows.
See, there's nostalgia. You just have to, you know, mention it and everyone gets all, like,
but
you know,
it's funny, people don't know. Like, well, younger people don't know the Love Boat. I've already explained how much I enjoyed it because, you know, people go on and they're lonely and they're lost and then they're on the Love Boat for like, what, 50 minutes or 44 minutes and they find the love of their life. Like, I grew up thinking that's kind of how life was going to work. It was very much a shock when life was neither like the sitcoms that I used to watch, like Life is Not Like Family Ties, and Life is Not Like Love Boat. You know, I didn't turn out to be the Fall Guy, nor is there a Fantasy Island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Crushing. I
very
know.
Crushing, yeah.
I know.
So what are we talking about this week?
Well, I mean, before we get into this we'd like to do a little recap, right? So what did we talk about last week, Aaron?
So last week was the second part where we discussed Brad's story. Brad and Don were here.
Right. Well, that's what we recorded most recently,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. The most recent episode is with our friend Allison.
Well... that will have already, we talked about that when we talked about
that. So that comes after.
Yeah. See, we're still getting used to this. It's okay.
Yeah, because we're ahead of the game at this point.
Right. When this comes out, the last episode that will have come out before this will be Brad's episode.
Wow.
I know, right? Well, and it's so strange because when you start a podcast, you don't really think about those things.
No.
You know, about the ordering of episodes, about the scheduling of guests, about getting guests prepared. It is a lot more work than
we anticipated. Yeah, a lot more work.
And in order to become professional with it, you end up doing things like professionals do. It turns out that the reason that they do them that way is because they work.
Absolutely.
And, you know, scheduling and all that stuff. It's very interesting. So, yes, even though it doesn't quite seem like it, according to our perspective right now, the last episode that will have come out will be good old Brad, our friend, and Don was back, and we discussed Brad's story and his recovery from addiction. And, you know, the focus is on long-term sobriety. Like, what does it look
like
after the year? Because there's so much attention, to, you know, in the movies about the first 30 days. And,
exactly,
you know,
right.
I got a month, and now that's fantastic, right? But what does it look like when you're successful, when your life is back together, and you still have to maintain that attitude of, I don't have it figured out.
Right, exactly.
Because the moment that I start thinking I'm safe, that's the moment when, you know, that occurs. But that was last week, and we are here this week with the White Shark.
Yeah, and if you want to catch up with our previous episodes, please feel free to go to our website. You can find us at www.toteachone.com. That's www.2TEACH1.com, and you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at TWOTEACHONE.
To Teach One.
That's right. So,
yeah, we're here with the White Shark, the big dog.
Yeah, if we've mentioned this guy quite a few times, and I mean, just based on all the names we've given him, you can imagine that you can't just coerce this man into coming on to share his wisdom and, you know, insight. Let's call it what it is. He's my best friend, and we've known each other for a while. His opinions are strong.
Yes,
and I was like, if anyone has something to say, it's Jacob. He's got to have a mind palace.
A mind palace. I like it. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it sounds awesome.
Where people like...
A fortress of the mind?
No, where people... It's a technique people use to remember things.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
I think it is called a mind palace.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, okay. He's probably just got like a giant library of things, rants, that are just waiting.
Ornate libraries in this palace filled with
all
wisdom.
All kinds of things he's waiting to unleash.
Yes. I agree.
Unleash is, doesn't sound good. Gift to the world.
I think unleash. good word.
Okay. Yeah, I think we've done it. So anyway, so my best friend's here. His name's Jacob Fry. He's a therapist working in the substance use disorder field. And we asked him to come in and talk. What's up?
Yeah, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, man. Welcome, dude.
Thank you.
Nice t-shirt.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
I always find it fascinating because in his professional aspect, Jacob dresses very well, like very much like a businessman.
Am I not dressed well?
No, you're dressed well, but you're dressed casually. Yeah. You know, not that it's not just as well in its own way, but very casually. And the dichotomy between the two is interesting, you know. It's kind of like a mullet, right? Business in the front and party in the back. You know?
Okay.
Just, you know what I mean?
Great analogy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's
you're not the first to have made that observation. Fair enough.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, Jacob, what's up, man? What have you been up to? How are you feeling about being here?
I'm honored to have been asked to come hang out with you guys.
Yeah, man.
Feeling pretty good about it.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Pretty soon, we're going to start using the outtakes and, you know, kind of publishing some of the stuff that happens before we actually start recording because, today was particularly interesting. You know, we really like Jacob, so we talked about all manner of things in about an hour and a half.
Oh, it comes off the rails quick.
Very. Yes, it does. Right? It careens wildly out of control a few times in an hour and a half. And, we'll see. It may do the same.
I'm sure it will at some point.
Yeah. So I asked you when I first approached you about coming onto the podcast. I was like, "Hey, I know you probably have some things to say, because you're very passionate about the work that you do." And I was thinking to myself, I was like, maybe you'd want to come on and discuss this topic of this whole unavoidable. Issue of people that get into recovery and there's a spiritual component, right? Some people have a spiritual life, some don't. And then, of course, there's the fact that, there's expectations. There's the, let's just say it, Christianity is pretty big, right? But not everyone falls, under the Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, people have all kinds of different beliefs, right? And sure. So... What do those people do? Is there a place for them? Can they still have as much success in this journey of recovery? And those are some of the questions that I wanted us to kind of discuss.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I know for those of you who are familiar with recovery, you'll know exactly what we're speaking of. But for those of you who may not be as familiar with recovery, I know in the movies it looks like just a bunch of people go into a room and they talk about how they've recovered from their addiction and everybody claps, but
it's like 30 people smoking in front of a church.
Yes, kind of exactly.
And drinking gratuitous amounts of coffee.
Yes. Yeah.
Excitable bunch.
Yeah. But they never actually show, even on some shows that I really think do a good job of covering what it's like to be in recovery, they don't really talk about what the steps are.
Right.
And for those of you who don't know, the steps are heavily tilted towards what they call moral psychology. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, coming to believe that a higher power can save you from addiction is literally part of the program, and then another step is turning your will and your life over to the care of that higher power. And those are some of the most difficult steps for a lot of people to sort of digest, right? The other part of the steps are more utilitarian, like write down all the things you did wrong, forgive yourself, forgive the people that wronged you, make amends, get rid of your defects. These are all laudable goals that anybody could do without really thinking about the religious aspect or the spiritual aspect. But those first few steps, they lean heavily on that. Mm-hmm. And I know that can present an issue for a lot of people.
Yeah, especially in the beginning, right? It's already like a new, every time, for a lot of people, when you embark on something new, doing something new, right? There's a level of discomfort there. So let alone that, now, say, you don't your beliefs don't match up with you know, the majority, right? Then you have to be confronted with that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, yeah, that's kind of like a double whammy. So I think for a lot of people, that's where it falls apart.
Yeah.
Some people are just like, I'm out. And then others are like, you know, I really want this, I'll stick around, but they're unsure of what it's going to look like.
Sure.
Going forward.
And I think too, the modern understanding of what addiction is much more fleshed out in the field of mental health than it was when that was written, which were the late 40s, I believe. Is that correct, Jacob?
So the book was written in 1935.
Right, 1935. Okay. So, we're even talking about the 30s. Mm-hmm. So when this was all written down, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, dialectical behavioral therapy, these things didn't exist. Mm-hmm. They were still working off what the Jungian model, where you sit down and talk to somebody for a long time. And now we have a lot more techniques, right, for mental health recovery. So how does that, you know, work into the traditional 12-step model? And then what does it look like for somebody who still wants to be involved in recovery, right, who thinks that's a vital step but doesn't see things in that viewpoint?
Right. That's an interesting question. You know, so maybe a good place to start is, you know, so why are one's beliefs or non-beliefs so important? You know, that's a reasonable question to ask.
Sure.
Right. So what do you think?
Well, it's pretty safe to say that most of us have either consciously or unconsciously lived our lives by our beliefs.
Right.
Whether they're playing a direct part in the decisions you're making or not. Most people stay within those confines. You know, they've been formed over a lifetime based on your experiences, based on, you know, your upbringing, your environment. We come to beliefs. We don't just get handed them. You can't get talked into believing something.
Right.
You know, not at your core, right?
You can
shake your head and smile and agree with something.
Right.
But to truly believe something is something that takes a while. You know,
yeah.
It's shaped. It's not, it's formed. It's grown. It's not something that just happens. And it's likely that those beliefs, whatever they are, have played a large part in what you're seeking help for. So therefore, it's the obvious next step that those should probably be a part of the help itself.
Right.
Because they're important to people, whether they understand it or not. And we're not even just talking about spiritual or religious beliefs. We're just talking about beliefs in general. People have these core beliefs.
Right.
But, you know, let's face it, our world has been shaped by religious beliefs. It makes sense that that's at the top of the hierarchy in people's core beliefs, you know,
right.
Whether or not they were living by those and that was the problem, or they were defying those and that was the problem in addiction.
Mm-hmm.
For people that adhere to something very rigid, it's going to be an obvious large part of their recovery.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what happens if...
Yeah, what happens if your
what happens
core
if,
beliefs...
Yeah, what happens if you don't have a place... You
yeah.
know, what happens if you don't even feel comfortable talking about what your beliefs are?
Yeah. I think that's fascinating too, that, you know, the founders of the original 12 steps, I know, there was one gentleman at the beginning who inserted, for those of you that don't know, when the steps talk about God, and they do mention God, they also say, as we understand him, you know, which is a very important thing to have there so that people who, you know, can at least find a way in, right? So even if you don't believe in God and still choose not to adhere to that, even that framework, there is something there for you to cling on to. Is that kind of how it worked for you?
No. simply put, no. So we might, you know, without getting into, you know, too much detail, those who know me, I would even go so far as to say those who know me well, maybe not acquaintances, but those who know me well would probably all agree 100% that I have some pretty unorthodox spiritual beliefs, some sort of arcane, esoteric beliefs. And not only did I have a hard time finding a place for that in my life? You know, obviously there was a hard time finding a place for that when I sought help, being a person in recovery myself.
Right. Right.
I sought help where folks told me I could get help.
Right.
And was immediately confronted with this, you know, this conflict, sort of, I guess for lack of a better term, sort of a moral conflict. You know, just, you know, it's pretty hard to put into words, but yeah. it was an immediate reaction, right?
Sure, yeah.
And immediately caused me to second guess whether or not this was the help
that you were seeking.
That I was seeking.
Right.
At the same time, knowing all too well that there wasn't a whole lot of other options.
Right.
And that's what it was, right? Like,
yeah.
That's where I found myself.
Right. So I see how that could be difficult. Now, the question is, how does that impact your or one's decision making?
Well, for me, and I think probably for everyone, our individual experiences, circumstances, core beliefs, thought patterns, both positive and negative, those lead to a completely unique interaction with the world, right?
Right.
This is all sort of woven together into a unified perception that influences everything you do. So whether that's, you know, addiction or recovery, whether it's a conscious or unconscious thing, decision, whatever you want to call it,
right.
It definitely is there, right? It's sort of guiding
everything
you do, or not, when you're in active addiction.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of people would argue that that's the problem with addiction is you're acting out of alignment with your own core beliefs. So obviously when seeking help, a person is trying to realign themselves
right.
with those beliefs, and then you're confronted with or told by, you know, this group of people that, oh, sorry, that doesn't align with what we've got in mind.
Right.
Yes.
And not immediately, I might add. It's sort of under this guise of, oh, no, it's as you believe it, or
right,
as
yeah,
you exactly. whatever. But then when you get into it, you realize it's actually far more rigid than that. This is just some things that have been said, right?
Right.
Or at least that's your perception.
Right.
My perception, I should say. I'll speak for myself. And that presents a whole nother decision to make, right?
Right.
Is this me or is this them kind of thing?
Right.
So in regards to the whole importance of the beliefs that we carry, particularly spiritual or the lack of spiritual
right.
beliefs, which is a belief, right? Like
yeah.
like they say,
yes.
Making no decision is making a decision, right?
Yes.
Right.
So the Journal of Substance Abuse Treatment listed the following examples of different practices that other scientific studies determined that people consider to be spiritual. So the first one is obviously a belief in God or a power that guides the universe. That's the one that people struggle with, I think. Either they do or they don't.
Right.
I mean, wars have been waged.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And continue to be waged.
Many have died, yeah.
The second is a faith in mystical or transcendental experiences. Then there is an adherence to a certain moral value. It could be even something as general as a broader-based construct that encompasses activities such as spending time in nature, engaging in artistic endeavors, improving personal diet and sleep patterns, any of those, right?
Right.
They take on a life of their own when they're incorporated into a belief system. As we said at the top of this, it's something that happens over time. It sort of grows. It's sort of, you know, it's an organic process, right? No one has, you don't like go somewhere and someone tells you to push A or push B. And then boom, it's immediately inserted.
Yeah. Right, right.
It happens, right? Which is why it is so difficult to, when confronted with no place for that or,
yeah.
or you know, whatever it is, it's so difficult to move forward.
Yeah, I know. I know it's interesting. The organic, the way that you've developed the thought that really points out this truth that is often overlooked, that any belief system, like you said, it's an organic thing that grows. Whereas there are certain religions who believe in that instantaneous, like, I will sit down with you, I'll talk to you for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Once you say these magic words, you are now in. And that it's, I think that that's so interesting that the entire place you're coming from is that, that that's not a real thing. That you can say those words, but it's even if you end up believing that way, it takes time.
It doesn't happen in that moment.
Yeah, your entire worldview has to shift, right?
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And also, like what you said about the organic wholeness of one's beliefs and that maybe the addiction process is acting outside of those, regardless of what they are.
Sure.
And coming back to that is important. And I could certainly understand how coming back to that and finding a group of people that in many ways is, and maybe for a long time, was like the only game in town, or at least the largest game. And somebody saying, hey, I'm not sure if you can play in this game. Mm-hmm. It has to be a difficult situation.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think even, you know, you said a little bit ago, you mentioned that it's a God as we,
yeah,
as we see him or whatever it is, but
as we understand,
as we understand him. Yes. Yeah. And so immediately for me, I'm like, what do you mean we? Why isn't it as I understand him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's almost like, you know,
yeah, no,
this group of
it.
People telling one person as we, you know, and I understand that that's probably not how it's meant, but when you're put in that place,
yeah,
you know, and you're, and like I said, I wasn't, I didn't have a whole lot of fight left in me, but I, there were a few things that I held dear and wasn't willing to give up on, and
yeah,
just had to kind of find a way in, a crack, right?
Yeah.
You know, a chink in their armor.
Yeah, I know for me, it's interesting because everybody approaches things differently, just like their own spiritual, you know, views. That phrase for me was, you know, the door through which I could find my way into accepting that, because I think the rigidity, because there certainly is a lot of rigidity in the first couple, you know, you must believe this one overriding thing for all the rest of it to have any power. And I don't know that I necessarily accept that, especially when you incorporate some of the modern, you know, mental health techniques that we know about that seem to work for me to be a lot more effective. Although I do adhere to the rest of the steps and the whole idea of spiritual principles and, you know, all that makes sense, right?
Sure.
And I see it work. But yeah, I certainly, I know, and I've talked about it on previous podcasts where when you go in and you read that, you're like, what does that even look like? Does this mean I'm going to start getting orders in my mind from some overwhelming, you know, deity? Like you take a left at the next light, walk 40 paces and say hello to the gentleman in the red tie. You know, and if I do start getting those things, I think that would freak me out. Like I would start thinking there was something wrong with me.
Hard pass.
Yes. Yes. It sounds much like being an automaton. And I certainly get how, especially newcomers, you come in and they tell you that, like, you're like, that doesn't even make any sense. Like, how does that even work? I mean, that's where I was at.
Well, and going back to the importance of a belief system, you know, some of it ties into the whole idea of powerlessness, right? Obviously, I was powerless over the substances that I was using and abusing and had become addicted to, which is why I sought help.
Right.
But to call myself powerless was just not part of my constitution.
Right.
In fact, I spent the majority of my life being very prideful of the fact that I rejected these sort of, you know, these religious dogmas, and I wasn't going to be that puppet. You know, I ate the apple.
Right.
I ate the fruit, man.
Yeah.
And going back to the importance of the beliefs, it shaped who I am. Like it's very much part of my identity.
Yeah.
And anyone that tells you that their beliefs are not part of their identity is not, I would argue that they don't really understand.
Yes.
You know, that's just how it works. That's the nature of the thing.
It is the nature of the thing, yeah.
And so that's why it's complicated when you're confronted with something that's quite literally the opposite.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm having my beliefs questioned. It's that I am a person who is being questioned as a living being, right? Like I'm having my existence questioned.
Yes.
So that's the difficulty.
Yeah, and no matter what, it's almost as if the recovery costs who you intrinsically are, then what is the point, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can't become other than you are and still maintain you know, any sort of organic sense of identity, I believe.
I think those are great points. And just to kind of play off of what you guys are discussing, right? I wrote down a couple of things here. So what I'm hearing is that there is a potential perception, you know, component here that is a big deal in, you know, in this whole thing, right?
Right.
So what role does perception play, you know? You chose some interesting words, you know, I feel, you know, as far as your first interaction, you know, being in this environment where, you know, you're confronted with, you know, these things that are happening, and many other people are. It's a very similar situation. It looks different for others, you know, but in this case, you know, you said, you know, you didn't have, you know, much fight left in you, and you had decided to do this. And so, you know, somehow you were able to find your way through, right? But, you know, you mentioned this perception thing. How does that play into things? Like, what's the role? I mean, either in your experience or, you know, because you've worked with quite a few people.
Sure.
Is there something you can say about perception and how it plays into it?
As a therapist,
yeah,
perception is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of my school of thought. Perception is everything. And I've sort of adopted that in my life as well.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, it would have done me a lot of good to be able to examine things from that perspective, or from a different perspective rather, sooner than I did.
Mm.
I just wasn't capable. I mean, it sounds cliche, but if you change the way that you're looking at things, everything changes, right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
And I got caught up, for lack of a better term, sort of pointing the finger and you know, no one's going to tell me what to believe. No one's going to tell me this and that and the other, when really by doing that, I'm doing the same, right? And that's what it all came down to, was changing my perception on it.
Right.
If I don't want anyone placing this proverbial roadblock purposely in front of me based on my own beliefs, then I can't hold someone else's understanding as a roadblock either. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
That seems to tie in with, like you were talking about, it's almost as if, without talking about a belief system, you've removed like the cognitive dissonance, right? Mm-hmm. You've removed the idea that, like you said, if you don't allow them to say to you,
right,
you're wrong in your beliefs, then you can't also say that to them. And regardless what the beliefs are, that seems like a very freeing idea set that allows you to move on.
It is. And yeah, funny enough, in a roundabout way, it kind of played into my whole, in my younger years, the aggressive rejection, right? Like, by allowing them their own, whatever it is, they're not, you know, they weren't able to get me.
Yeah. Right.
it makes perfect sense in my head, I promise.
No, I fully understand it. And a personal disclosure, as a younger gentleman, I think we thought along a lot of the same lines. And where I grew up, I remember stating that belief one time and it being like a huge deal in the classroom that I was at in 11th grade, you know? And so I think being able to see it from both sides, right? And not both sides as in like, I see your argument and I see this argument and let's talk about it and mediate it. Not like that, but just very simple. Like, okay, if I'm not going to let you dictate to me, then I'm not going to dictate to you. And that being, even when you were younger, when you're like, that's the deal, like you just stay over there and do your thing, I'll be over here to do my thing, we're cool. Yeah, you don't have to come and try to proselytize to me. I'm also not going to proselytize to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Where was this?
This was in deep in the heart of Texas, in the thick of the Bible Belt.
Bible Belt.
And not to denigrate anybody's religion, but they used to literally, like in class, like they would pass out these booklets and the teachers were fine with it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I wanted to pass out my alternative spirituality books that I read a lot, and I don't know if anybody's read Jonathan Livingston Seagull, but I was really into that mode of thought, and they didn't like that.
Hold on. How old were you, and were you reading this book? Were you reading those kind of books at that point?
Yeah, I was reading those books in like 6th and 7th grade. Religion has always been fascinating to me. And
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I
theology in and of itself is just a really based on what it's done to the entire world or allowed the world to do.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
And it's interesting. We come at it from a different, my thinking was, you know, that's why I studied philosophy in college. And it's always been what is that? And what does it mean? And, you know, how much truth is there and different religious viewpoints and that kind of thing. But yeah, when you start talking about that in seventh grade Texas, it is not necessarily well received. And I remember that because they would pass out these booklets and they were very clear. They're like, you either believe this set of things. I remember this girl in my class named Megan, we used to always get into it because she would pass out these little booklets and it had a little stick figure. And they were like, see, it have a little man on a ladder, right? And if he didn't accept this one viewpoint, then he was going to fall from the ladder into the fiery pit, right? And burn forevermore. And if he did, then he was saved. And it was just that simple. And there was even like a little space in the back where all you had to do was write that you believed this and you were good. And that's what I was talking about earlier, in that idea that I could talk to somebody for 15 minutes and they say the magic words and now the universe is working with them in an entirely different fashion, which I just think doesn't take into account how spirituality and belief systems work in real humans, right? And in real life. You can say it to believe it, to be where you're at, to fit in, but how much of it is truth in the sense of you've now taken it into who you are and made it part of you.
To put it in the parlance of our times, I think I think I would be doing us all a disservice if I didn't draw the comparison to the most recent episodes of Game of Thrones, where Jon Snow was confronted with having to bend the knee. And just the act of bending the knee was such a big deal to the people of the North. And you guys are looking at me like you don't understand what I'm talking about.
I have never watched. Well, okay. I got to about season two.
The listeners will get it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah.
The Carters.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. Huh. Yeah. Game of Thrones is hilarious because I was so mad after the end of season three. So mad. That I have never, like, at some point I will watch it because I found it an interesting and good show, but I was so mad after the Red Wedding that I have not been back.
You're not alone. Many had issues with that. So like I said earlier, I had two things that I had made a note of. So perception was one of them. Mm-hmm. The other thing was I wanted to bring up this observation that I've made, that free thinkers make up a majority of the people that we're talking about with these, you know, alternative spiritual beliefs. Is that true? And what does that even, you know, free thinkers, you know,
So it's a sort of, I think oftentimes a misused term, or at the very least misunderstood term.
Right.
I definitely consider myself to be a free thinker. The others that I know that would identify themselves as free thinkers, I think what I would definitely, define that as more of just a outside the box.
Right. Yeah.
You know, a lot of atheists would call themselves free thinkers.
Right.
That's not what I mean by that when I refer to myself as a free thinker.
Right.
So it's kind of a difficult term.
Okay.
Right. It means something different to everybody.
Right.
Interestingly enough, there is a free thinkers in AA group.
Oh, interesting.
Which is borderline secular, but it's an oddity because it's based on, it's AA, right? And okay. It's 12 steps.
Okay.
But what they've done was they have rather cleverly removed all of the or found a way around all the higher power talk,
right,
in the step work.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
It's still kind of trying to gain its footing. It's been around a little while though. They got their own flyers and all of that stuff. But again, it's just the wording. It's just the language, right? Like when you get into the meat of it, it's still the same. It's still the same stuff. Because you're dealing with people, right?
Yeah.
And no matter what you do, you're going to be dealing with people, and that's where the difficulty is. It's not the
Well, I know for me, I found having studied philosophy and sort of the history of religion, I recognized the parts of the steps as being much older than any individual religious tradition, that the current major religious systems that we have today in our society take their roots from ones that existed before. Mm-hmm. And so much older philosophies and religions and spiritual systems. So, you know, this basic idea, I always just boil it down to, you know, I did something wrong. Let me talk about it. Let me get it off my chest. Let me forgive the people that wronged me, and you know, let me move on with my life. Right. So I never personally never had to, I didn't bog down too much in this idea of the spiritual thing. Like that's what I had to get over in my own way, was trying to define it, trying to understand what it was, trying to figure out if I'm right or if somebody else is right, and just kind of move past it. But I think in essence, it's an old, old tradition to like go to somebody and be like, here's all the stuff I did wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, will you please, let's go over how much of that was my fault and how much of it was the people who are doing something wrong. And let me just go to everybody that I stole $5 from you. And let me say, hey, here's your $5 back. It's a very old, old tradition that kind of transcended religion for me mm-hmm. when I looked at it from that point. But yeah, you know, steps 2 and 3, I just sort of had to like be like, I don't know what that looks like. So I'm just going to, like you said, kind of nod my head and just move forward mm-hmm. and then just make it work somehow. Right. Yeah. But I definitely encountered my share. So for those of you who aren't familiar with recovery, let me just say that the tradition in most of the 12-step groups is to have a person that you call a sponsor that you look to for guidance and who kind of tells you more or less kind of what to do, right? It's like, let's work this step. Okay, well, how are we going to work it? Well, let me show you how we're going to work it.
Right.
And definitely, because my first foray into 12-step work was in Texas, the majority of the people that I worked with definitely took it very seriously, like the prayer on the knees and that kind of thing. But I did work with this one guy. It was really interesting because it was very freeing for me. Because finally I found somebody who, he said to me, even though he had a religious tradition, he was like, my job is to see you get sober. He's like, salvation, that is a totally separate thing. You want to talk about it someday? I will happily engage you in this discussion. But that's not what we're here to do.
Right. Okay.
And I was like, cool. He was like, you believe what you want to believe. Like, hey, just find something that works for you. Mm-hmm. A way to get past what you believe now. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do it that way.
Yeah. I think I also got what I call lucky by encountering the right people.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is where it definitely helped to be out of fight, like I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Because I don't think I may or may not have gotten to that point. I may not have kept looking until I found the right people, uh-huh. Which was part of the learning experience as well for myself in regards to the belief system, right? I had to loosen my own rigidity long enough to find that there were people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That didn't necessarily take that hard and fast mm-hmm. approach. And that's kind of the good and the bad thing about the 12-step community when it says it has no governance. You know, there's all kinds of interpretations and groups.
Yeah. Well, so, it's I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh,
but,
no, go ahead. Yeah.
You know, it's we can talk about the whole spirituality or God problem till the cows come home. I don't know sure. that there's any listeners that don't understand why that's a problem.
Right? Yeah, no, I agree.
But what they may not understand is some of the other things that you encounter, some of the subtleties that really ingrain these problems that not only keep people from getting help, but may also further damage the people seeking help.
Yeah,
when they're sent back out, right? You know, there's a whole myriad of things that you encounter. Now, myself, as a person with these unorthodox spiritual beliefs, once it was fully apparent that I was going to stick around and do this thing and I started getting into the meat of stuff, that's when all of these subtleties started coming out. Really, really a lot of stuff that I'd never really thought through and didn't ever expect to experience, right? So there's a lot of shame and guilt that gets compounded. I didn't come in on a winning streak, right?
No.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't come in just to take myself down, you know, a few pegs and get on with my life. I came in because I was a broken human being. There was already some inherent shame and guilt.
Yeah.
Just over the way that I'd lived my life, the decisions I'd made, you know, is this me as a person? All this stuff, right? And then when you're told that the belief system, the thing that's helped shaped you into this person,
yeah,
is also wrong. I mean, it's devastating.
Yeah.
You know, because then it goes from, okay, maybe I might not be able to get help here, to maybe I'm not helpable.
Yeah.
I'm aware that's not a word.
But no, we'll make it one.
Yeah, it is, for the sake of this discussion.
That comes with your right to do a podcast.
And so that furthers the cycle, right?
Yeah.
That it could. And the way that my brain works is like, okay, well, if I'm incapable of getting help, then I'm going to be really, really incapable of getting help.
Yeah, then let's just take it to the max. I will show you
what this person looks like. You know, that's just how my brain works.
Sure.
Right?
No, I get
it. So just my experience personally, that's where that was a problem, you know, and I didn't anticipate that. I didn't anticipate being further shamed and acquiring more guilt going to somewhere to get help. You know, I'm aware. I have plenty. I'm all full up over here. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's move on. Kind of like, what do I do with it? Right.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting about it, is, and I bet I'm not alone on this, but I sort of identified not only the 12-step community, but sobriety with that experience, which just further alienated me from recovery in general.
That's interesting.
Right? Yeah. Why would you want to get sober if that's what it's going to be like?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I now know much better than that, but, you know, I was working with damaged equipment.
Well, yeah. And the whole purpose is supposed to be for the newcomer, right?
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah.
And that's what they say. The newcomer is important. I was told I was the most important person in the room.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And then to
But find, only yeah, if you, this, and this. Right,
right. Right.
You can believe whatever you want as long as it's this, and this.
Yes.
You know? And then to furthermore go, oh, that's cute. Eventually you'll believe this, and this. It's like,
you do encounter that a lot. I can attest.
And I
that.
Get it.
Yeah.
It's people. You got to keep plugging. You got to keep looking for the folks that aren't, you know, because that's out in the world, right? That's not just the 12-step community.
Yes.
That in and of itself encompasses, you know, sort of how my beliefs developed into what they are.
Yeah.
I just didn't anticipate it being, you know, so tightly wound around the recovery community.
You know, I agree. And when you look at some of the tradition, not the formal traditions that are actually written down, but just some of the things that happen in the group. I don't know, we had discussed the other day, you know, there a lot of meetings end with a formal prayer that's taken directly out of one of the spiritual texts.
Right. After declaring that this is a spiritual, non-religious group.
Yeah. Yes.
Then that gets brought right back in. And if you were somebody who really didn't appreciate that, you know, that would turn you off. And
at the very least, it's confusing.
Yes. Okay.
I'm like, wait a minute. Did we?
Didn't we?
Somebody playing a trick on me? Did we?
Right.
I could have swore we just went over this.
Yeah. I get that. And it's an important perspective to talk about, because there are so many people who desperately need help, and they're sent to this place. And, you know, I think too, it goes back to the idea that the unique structure of the program is that there's no one person who can say, hey, you stop doing this and you stop doing that, but that everybody has their own opinion. So you can run into somebody with many, many years who has a position of responsibility who may say some things to you that you're like, that doesn't seem correct at all. And there literally is no one you can go to and say, this person is acting outside of the way that they should. Mm-hmm. Can you please fix that? No. But it does, if you, I don't know if, you know, luck or providence or however you wanted to put it, if you find the right people, then you can still do the program from a non-religious perspective. It can be done, obviously, because you did it.
Yeah. And I know now that what I call luck actually was a byproduct of my persistence and actual fight that that I did have in me. But, yes. You know, it's the funny thing is that I realized at one point that, like all at once, it just kind of washed over me that I was identifying as part of my identity this belief system, right? That I was identifying more with my tendency to have to make other people understand that belief system and announce that belief system and all of these things. Like I wanted to make sure people knew that I wasn't falling for it, that I wasn't, you know, that I ate the apple, right?
Yes.
And in actuality, I was identifying with that. I wasn't actually identifying with my own beliefs.
Yeah.
I was identifying with the defiance.
Yes, the right? need to have people.
And as
know
long
that,
as I'm wrapped up in that,
I'm not. That's it.
I don't know how to better explain it.
I think you hit the nail on the head.
So my question is, you know, based on what you just said right there, right? When you're working with other people, how often do you see that come up? You know, and because of what you went through, you're like, oh, let's look at that.
You know, it's probably the most important thing that I learned, not only about myself and my recovery, but just how to interact with the world.
Yeah.
Because this goes outside the boundaries of just a system of beliefs.
Right.
Because there's lots of disagreements with people.
True.
I mean, there's so many, you know, and every single one of them is different. You know, I was told recently that not everybody's different. And I just do not believe that. We are all different. Yeah. That's a fundamental reality.
We're unique. Yes.
Right. Having taken that on board as much as I did, I don't find it all that difficult when working with people. It comes up all the time, daily, right? But I've done so much work on it that my brain automatically goes now to the more, you know, this isn't about you, this is about this person, right?
Yes.
You know, and obviously as a clinician, one of the first things you learn is that, you know, this, I don't get to buy into this, right? Like I don't get to offer my not on that.
Right.
You know, I'm there to guide and to treat. I'm not there to tell somebody that their, you know, belief system is.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. So that's on your end, right? So as someone who's guiding others, right, do you see some of you, you know, and some of those experiences that you had, like do you watch as they're experiencing something similar? And, you know, how does your insight assist you in kind of navigating, you know, how to guide them?
That's a little more difficult because, you know, I think as we've demonstrated over the last little while here, it's not something that's easily explained. My experience was my experience. And while I learned from it, it's not necessarily something that I can like write a manual about.
Yeah.
Because they may not encounter the same things at the same time in the same order, you know.
Right.
I give them the pieces of insight that I can that I know will help them keep trying.
Right.
Right. But you know, I guess it's really all geared around not getting hung up on stuff, you know.
When you boil it down, that's basically what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're still allowed to retain your own, you know, the integrity of your own belief system. You're going to have to be a little flexible. And if other people aren't flexible, that can't determine your level of flexibility.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So what about those people who may have experienced like, you know, things like religious trauma, right? Because there's many layers to this, right? There's many reasons why people find themselves, you know, in conflict with, you know, the beliefs that are set before them. Right.
Yeah.
Or inadvertently, in a way, right? So what about that? What about those people?
That's a difficult one. I haven't personally experienced any direct religious trauma.
Yeah.
You know, I had some experiences with relatives and friends of relatives and things like that as a child that I do believe helped shape my sort of disbelief, if you will.
Yeah. Yes.
To
yeah.
put it nicely.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I would consider that to be traumatic. But I have come in contact with some people, worked with some people, know some people who, now I'm completely aware that trauma is subjective, right?
Right.
Who have experienced some religious traumas, either people that were previously members of a church and, you know, the thing that we all hear about happened, you know, they were
right.
Either molested or, you know, sexually abused over a period of time by a person of trust, a right. person in the church,
right.
or, a fellow churchgoer, whatever it is.
Right. Or even in the home, right? What if one of the parents is right, just what I would, you know, call like, you know, a little bit extremely, you know, religious, right? And they're, you know, talking about these things. They live, eat, breathe this, right? But yet what they're doing isn't in line with, you know, what they're trying to put out, right? So that can actually, you know, that's another way that can happen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it can also be... and I would imagine that there's a large number of the people in recovery in the LGBTQ community that can probably attest to this. I know a few people that have experienced problems with the church because of their own sexual orientation.
Right.
Who are other, you know, wonderful people. They have, you know, very strong religious beliefs, but right. they're not welcome to practice or worship with the church that they were brought up in. Or even with the family that they were originally, you know, exposed to it
right,
with.
Right.
Once they, you know, made their sexual orientation public knowledge.
Right.
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 And tried to move on with their lives. They were sort of ostracized or what have you, you know, alienated. And so when, you know, seeking help, and that's the first thing that you encounter is this right. thing that traumatized you.
Right.
I can't even imagine trying to work through that.
I can. Yeah, it's incredibly difficult, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many layers to that one.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is an interesting idea that, you know, those we put in our mind, especially as children in positions of trust, even if the trauma isn't so overt or explicit as, you know, them doing something to you, if you see some people who, you know, appear to proselytize, to say you should live and believe in this way, and then they don't, I found for me that calls everything into question, because I hold somebody in a higher standard. If they say, I am a member of this organization and I have been trained in it and I, you know, give services in it, and then if they don't act in that way, which I think is why... The idea, again, that in the 12-step community, no one speaks for them. But there's not a group of people who have been specially trained who go forth and say, this is the gospel according to the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in seeing that, that also, in my, you know, formed some of my ideals about what that is and what it ought to look like. And it's so interesting to me that... So many people that I know, like I really don't know a lot of people who have bought in wholeheartedly to that one strict interpretation of that thing. Everybody I know that seems to be the most successful at it, like you said earlier, found a way to not get hung up on the thing that they objected with and just move on.
Yeah, you gotta be malleable.
Yeah.
You know? You gotta be above it.
Because, you know, ultimately what we're talking about, right, is changing our patterns of behavior, changing, you know, the way we think about how we ought to live our life. And yet that doesn't necessarily have to mean you have to change the way that you intrinsically view what the world is, which is kind of what a religious...
You have to change the way that your behavior is aligned
yes.
with that system.
Yeah, not right. necessarily what that system is. And, you know,
but they don't explain that to you.
No, they don't.
It's just got this and got that. And,
yeah.
You know.
But when you go deep into the most successful people, at least, and I don't mean just in years. I no longer view that. I mean the happy people. Like the people who are living successful, happy lives that enjoy themselves and yet have found a way to survive sober.
right? They don't have to put something in their body constantly to change the way that they feel. And they are not walking around as angry people.
Right.
Which is different, because you can find a lot of angry people who got many years of sobriety, and I don't quite understand how they do it. But there are also some people who are really enjoying life and getting the most out of it. And those are the people, I think, that are the less, they're not that rigid. And they're open to the idea that, well, whatever works for you.
Well, they may be that rigid, but they don't impose those definitions onto others.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That's where we're working with people.
Yeah.
That's where it becomes important. You can be as rigid as you want.
Right.
But you can't be rigid for someone else.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, no one wants to be told what to do. And we want even less to be told what to believe.
Yes.
Right? Like we said, wars have been waged.
That's true.
The fires are burning right now
across
the ocean, you know, and it's all over what we're talking about.
That is so true.
And so I'm supposed to go get help and talk about this.
Yeah.
With no weapon or, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
It's such a huge topic to deal with.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think this next point is very much related to, you know, what you were just discussing, right? So it says, so the language we use, like oftentimes there's common ground, but the language we use to describe our experiences is often too rigid to make room for obvious commonalities. Tell me about that, Jacob.
All right. So we're breaking into the episode. We're actually going to make Jacob's episode a two-parter because
there's
so much to say and so much to listen to.
So much.
So we'd like for you to be able to take a little break. And we just want to thank Jacob again for being here.
Go ahead. Pour yourself a nice tea and check into part two.
Absolutely. See you next time.
Yeah.